Good morning. Welcome to Midtown 12 South. My name is Elliot. I'm the pastor here. Glad that you've decided to join us this morning. There was a bunch of heathens that came to the 9 o'clock because they had to get here before the Titans game started. So I'm glad that you have your priorities in line. Also, if you don't know, the Titans is our local football team. I know half of you don't care. But I'm very excited today. We begin our new fall series that I'm very much looking forward to. And if I'm honest, a little intimidated by to begin. We are beginning a series on the letter to the Hebrews in the New Testament. It's near the end of the New Testament. It's about 8 or 9 books from the end of the New Testament. Talking to my daughter last night, she was hoping that this book, she's 12, almost 13, she was hoping that this book was 6 or 7 books from the end of the Old Testament, so she could say 6, 7, there we go, yeah. And everyone over 30 is like, what are you talking about? I've not been drinking this morning. 6, 7 is a thing. And if you act like you know about it, you don't, okay? Okay, everyone just says it. They don't know what it means. But I know, came from TikTok, whatever. So this book is about 8, that was not in my notes. This is, it's about 7 or 8 books from the end of the New Testament. If you want to turn there, let me give a little intro to it briefly. So most scholars would tell you that they don't believe that the book of Hebrews was actually a letter. It's called a letter to the Hebrews, but it was actually probably a sermon or a series of sermons, short homilies to a group of people that someone recorded. And then it was passed and distributed around throughout the Mediterranean world like a letter would have been, but its original form, its original context was a sermon. And that sermon has a theme. And that theme, from the first chapter to the 13th chapter, that sermon is all about one thing. The overarching theme of this sermon is this. The sermon to the Hebrews is this. Jesus is better. Jesus is better than anything and everything. Jesus is better, Jesus is better, Jesus is better. Now, the context of who the preacher or the speaker wanted to give that news and that theme to, that Jesus is better, he's speaking to a group of people, first century Jews, first century Hebrew people who had been raised in the Jewish faith. And so for his context to want to show that Jesus is better, here's actually the context of, or the way he wants to show Jesus is better is this. Jesus is better than every single Old Testament reality and Hebrew tradition that you have hung your hat on. Like, hey, Hebrews, I know, and Jews, I know that you are the Lord's chosen people, and he has come to you, and he dwelt among you, and he revealed himself to you through the Old Testament. But now some things have shifted, and everything about your Old Testament, everything about all of your forefathers and the sacrificial systems and the temple and everything, the promised land, everything you once hung your hat on, I need you to know Jesus is better than all those things. Now, it's not necessarily like a competition, like Jesus beat the Old Testament. It's actually better than that. It's actually that Jesus is the completion of the Old Testament. Jesus is what all the Old Testament was pointing towards. That the Old Testament was like a movie preview, getting you ready for something. And now Jesus, the movie, the blockbuster, is here. He's come. He's better than the preview. He's the real thing. Jesus is better. Now, because this speaker, this author, wants to show the listener, the reader, that Jesus is better than all the Old Testament realities that they had believed in and hoped for and hung their hat on, it means that the context of this letter can be quite difficult to understand many times, especially if one doesn't have a deep familiarity with the Old Testament. So the author presumes, the speaker presumes, that everyone that originally listened to this knew the Old Testament forwards and backwards. And like little nuances and traditions and characters and things that were going on in the life of the Old Testament, life of Israel in the Old Testament, the author is presuming that you basically have a PhD. The author of Hebrews is presuming that you have a PhD in the Old Testament, which can make the book really daunting to preach through and to follow along with. Several theologians said they believe that in the New Testament, Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, is second only to the book of Revelation when it comes to difficult to understand books in the New Testament. And we preached on Revelation a few years ago, so y'all have got that. Like, it's totally been mastered. But now we're moving to number two, the second most challenging book to understand, which is the book of Hebrews. So I'm very excited and a little daunted by the task to try to unearth the Jesus is betterness from every page. But as you read it, it would be really easy to believe or to experience the read-through or the listen-through of the book of Hebrews that the author or the speaker would want you to know that Jesus is better. It can sound like a textbook. It can sound like a doctrinal lobotomy that like, it's a fire hydrant of theological truths, and it is. But the author of Hebrews is far more pastoral than that. Again, if you understand that it's a, like a pastor preaching a sermon, there's such a heartfelt reality to this book that the speaker wants not just to show you that Jesus is better and have you theologically or mentally agree with him. The speaker, the author of the book of Hebrews, wants to invite you into experiencing the Jesus who is better than everything. The author wants to give you a personal revelation, a personal reality for your psyche to experience, that you would leave not just agreeing with him that Jesus is better, but you would leave after experiencing the book of Hebrews having tasted that Jesus is better than everything. Which is why, and you can throw this slide up, the slide for our series, we're calling it this fall, Draw Near, the Gospel According to Hebrews. Draw near as in, this book is going to invite you each week, each section, to draw near to the Jesus, to experience this Jesus, like in your soul and psyche, that is better than anything and everything. That you would not just leave here having checked the box to be able to defend and argue and understand why Jesus is better, but you would leave here having tasted that Jesus is better. Calling it the Gospel According to Hebrews because some scholars would say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four eyewitness gospel accounts that we have in the New Testament that tell you about Jesus. If you want to get to know Jesus, go read the Gospels. Some people would call Hebrews the fifth gospel, that it is a deep encounter, just like the Gospels are, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Hebrews is another way to encounter and experience the same Jesus. So draw near. The Gospel According to Hebrews is what we begin today. So each week, here's the framework. We're going to present it in the same way, and you'll see the sermon titles that reflect this. Here is Jesus, here's who he is, here's what he did, and here's why he's better than everything. That's what we're going to do each week up until Advent. So Hebrews 1, 1 through 4, we will move at a faster pace than that, I promise. We're only covering four verses today, but it has plenty to extract from it. So here we go. This is Hebrews chapter 1, starting in verse 1, reading the first four verses, says this. It says, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. Again, that's like the whole Old Testament he discovered in one sentence. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name that he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Okay, three things to notice from our text. And you need to know, if you're new or visiting, that I typically only use a three-point outline when there's too much to cover. So we're going to try to simplify this down. We could uncover a 15-point sermon based on this passage. We're just going to do three. Our text is answering these three questions for us. Who is Jesus? What did Jesus do? And what is Jesus doing, like in the present? Who is Jesus? What did Jesus do? And what is Jesus doing? Okay, so first, who is Jesus? There are several passages in the New Testament that are known as theologically dense. Like Ephesians chapter 1, the first 18 verses of Ephesians chapter 1 is all one run-on sentence from Paul. And he's packing a lot into one kind of ADD thought on Jesus and his excellency. This is another one of those sections, this opening four verses of Hebrews. And it's not a competition, but I don't know of a section in the New Testament that is more theologically dense than these first four verses of Hebrews chapter 1. Certainly there are some maybe as dense, but not in four verses. We get a lot packed in here. So let's look at this again. Verse 1 through the first part of 3 is where we're going to start. It says, long ago, and many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. Again, that's whole Old Testament, just one sentence. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. Okay, this is in reference to the being of God, like the ontology, the essence of God, the being. And here's what the author just told you. The Son, Jesus, God the Son, is the exact representation, the exact embodiment of God in his full ontological self as God really is. God is fully manifest in Jesus. So that, this is what you should leave believing or understanding is his premise. If you look at Jesus, you have seen God. If you want to know what God is really, really like, truly like in his fullness, look at Jesus. Lots of things can show you about the Lord. Lots of things can teach you about the Lord. Nature can, beauty can, people can, who are made, the Imago Dei, people made in God's image. They can all show you realities about the Lord, but nothing represents and reveals the Lord better than the Lord himself can reveal himself. And Jesus is God in the flesh. So if you want to know what God is like, look at Jesus, because he is the exact imprint, the exact representation of God's nature. He is the radiance of God's glory. It's been said before, God the Son, Jesus, is God's supreme self-expression. Book of John, John chapter 1 calls Jesus the Logos, the Logos. He is God's word, meaning words represent what you were trying to communicate, like your literal words express who you are. And what John 1 and Hebrews 1 is saying is Jesus is the full expression of God's self-revelation. God wanting to reveal himself. He has done it in certain ways in the past, revealed himself. We'll talk about that. But now he has done it through Jesus. Verse 1 told you that in the Old Testament times, God was a revealing God. God revealed himself. He spoke through in many times in many ways. He spoke through angels. The angel of the Lord will come and reveal things about the Lord to people. He spoke through prophets. He spoke through patriarchs. He spoke through kings. He disseminated information in his will and his heart to people that copied it down and then shared those copies with God's people. God revealed himself through narratives and stories and hymns and proverbs and poetry and parables and love songs and wisdom literature and apocalyptic literature. Abraham, Isaac, burning bushes with Moses, Joshua, David, the prophets, major and minor prophets. God had a way in the Old Testament to reveal himself, to let people know who he was and what he was like, and it was sufficient for the time. But now, God has fully and finally spoken another word that's not written down and read by people. It's through a person, through Jesus. And there is no better revealing of who God is to the world than the revealing that God has done through Jesus. Okay, that's the premise of the first couple of verses. Now, let me just talk about what that is saying and what that means. It's a lovely reality. It's a lovely attribute of God that God reveals himself. What a marvel that the infinite one, the supreme being in all the universe, the one who created the universe, is also a being that wants to reveal himself, that wants to be known by people. Now that's great, it's beautiful, it's lovely. God speaks, woohoo. Here's the problem, here's where that reality that God is a revealing God and that the supreme being is a self-revealing God, and here's where it becomes infuriating, because you can't control what he reveals or how he reveals it. Meaning this, God's self-revelation means that the truest things in the universe are realities that can't be discovered but must be revealed. See, because discovery is like going on a treasure hunt. Discovery means like you climb, you achieve, you pursue, you extract for yourself, and then you get to the top of the mountain of knowledge or wisdom or truth or understanding, and you climbed there and you got the heights of understanding because you discovered it. Revelation means you receive what the revealer wants to disclose. See, one, discovery creates arrogance. I went after this treasure and I found it. And I did it better than you, and I understand it better than you. And so I'm a superior being because I discovered truth for myself. Discovery creates arrogance. Revelation creates dependence. This is a heavy word or a complex word, but this deals with what's known as epistemology, like dealing with knowledge. How do you believe that human beings can know anything? Is it discovery or revelation? Do you work on it and you understand it because you climbed it, or is it revealed to you because the Supreme One decided to reveal it to you? One creates arrogance, the other creates dependence. And we believe, and what Hebrews 1, 1 through 3 is saying, is that the deepest realities of God must be revealed to you, not discovered by you. And again, that should not shock us. Like when we measure ourselves up, if you understand the delta and the space and the gap between you as a finite creature and him, the infinite creator, like there's a gap between you and him, a big one. But if God and you are equals, if us and God are equal beings and equal in capacity and equal in brilliance, then you should be able to discover him on your own. But if we and the Lord, if he's high above us, if he's above the heavens, it should make sense to you that the only way you can know anything about him is if he chooses to reveal something about himself to you. So I used to teach middle school Bible here. The worst years of my life. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I loved it. A lot of my former students are here. I loved it. Kind of. I used to open the year with this question, this epistemological question. And it's a little hypothetical, but roll with it, okay? Try to answer it in your mind. I used to ask this question, how would the character of Harry Potter, the goat, how would the character of Harry Potter get to know the author, J.K. Rowling? How would the character of Harry get to know personally the author of J.K. Rowling? And they all failed. No one got it right. Because here's the answer, of course, and it makes sense when you put it in those categories. The only way for a character in a story that's been created to get to know the author and the creator is if the author writes themselves into the story and becomes a character, and the author would fully embody themselves as this character, and then the characters in the story at Hogwarts and Harry would get to know J.K. the character. Like, Harry cannot, as great as he is, he's the best, he's my best friend. Harry cannot imagine J.K. Rowling. Like, nothing about him would make him think he's a created character of an author. Harry can't know J.K. Harry can't discover J.K. by reading books at the library. Only if J.K. creates a character in the world of Harry Potter and writes herself into the pages, lives with the characters as a true representation of the author herself, only then could Harry get to know her. That's what Hebrews just told you about Jesus. Jesus is God himself writing himself into the story in order to fully reveal himself to the characters, in order to reveal himself to what he has made. That's the first thing. That's who Jesus is. Jesus is the exact representation of his nature. He is the radiance of the glory of God. He is the revelation of God to you, fully God. He represents him perfectly. But not only is this passage telling you who Jesus is, it's answering this question. What did Jesus do? This revealer of God in all of his glory. What did he do? Look at verse 3 with me again. It says, he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. After making purification for sins. Purification is a word, Greek word, that means literally to cleanse from an inward pollution. It's a cleaning that goes from the inside out for the thing that's being purified. It is not a wiping down of the outside. It is a cleansing from within. Now, we hear the word purification, and that's what that word means, and it does mean something to us. And maybe you have even a biblical understanding of it. But for the original audience here, purification was a depth charge. Purification was an atom bomb word for them. Like the original hearers, Jews in the first century, purification was like an industry term in our city. Like if you work in the music biz and you hear someone say like, oh, I got a pub deal, I got a record deal. It's like, those all mean things. Those all have like miles of meaning behind them that if you're outside the music industry, you may go, I've heard of records, but I don't really know what all that means. To say in the opening line to a group of Hebrews, to a group of Jews, Jesus made purification for sins. Here's what every Jew knew. Here's what every Hebrew knew. There is no purification without blood. So what the author just told you is that the one who is the exact representation of the nature of God is also one that died. He's one that shed his blood for the inner cleansing of the problem of sin. Purification was at the core of the Jewish religion. And this author just said, of all the things that Jesus did, which we'll get to a lot more of, but of all the things that Jesus did, this is what I want you to know first in the opening lines, that the purification of sins is what Jesus did. And if you stay with us for this series, which I hope you do, there will be much more on the purification of sins, like entire chapters dedicated to the purification of sins. And we'll get to it, but it's really interesting that he brings it up here. And so in order to go, like, why did he bring up that reality in these opening verses? Because there's no mention here of how he did it. There's no mention of a cross. There's no mention of a sacrificial system. There's no mention of anything as to how the person of Jesus actually made purification for sins, because the author is not concerned with that right now. The author doesn't want to tell you how he purified your sins and you from your sins. He wants to tell you what that means about him. See, the context here, context so matters. The context here is that Jesus is the exact representation of God. He's the radiance of his glory. He is the exact representation of his nature. If you look at Jesus, you've seen God. And so what he's trying to tell you is that that God, whose perfect representation is in the person of Jesus, his son, what that son did was made purification for Jesus. So what he's trying to tell you is, do you know what that says about God? This is what God is like. This is the kind of God he is. See, it's hard for us, especially if you've grown up like church adjacent or near or around the church. When you hear like the term purification for sins, like that's forgiveness and that's atonement and all those things are true, but it's really hard to hear the news of that and not immediately make it about what does that mean for me? Like, what is the purification of sins by Jesus? What does that mean for my life? And there is plenty that it means for your life. We'll get to that. But of all the things that Jesus came to do and of all the things that he could have talked about, he inserts here what Jesus did because he wants that reality of making purification for sins to be the first thing that you know tells you something about who God is. This is the kind of God who could do anything he wanted, and what he chose to do was make purification for your sin. See, the making purification for sins has to do with you, but this opening section is not about you. It's for you, it's just not about you. So connect this line, follow this train of thought. Jesus is the perfect representation of who God is. He's the exact imprint of his nature. And he came to purify you from sin because that's who God is. God is the God of the Bible is the kind of God who comes and dies to cleanse his people. That's who he is. Please do not miss this beauty amongst this density. This is the kind of God who comes into the story that he's writing, and he comes into his creation as a creature in order to purify his creatures for sin that they have committed against him and to pay for the atonement of what his creatures had done committing treason against him. That's the kind of God he is. Like, can you imagine if J.K. had written herself into the story of Harry Potter and into the storyline, and then in the storyline, she writes her character, her creature, as the one who's like living and breathing in the world of Harry Potter. Her creature is the one who would die for the creatures that she had made that rebelled against her, the author. Like, she's holding the pen. She's writing the story. No author to try to like embody who they are and reveal themselves to their creation and to their creatures would ever write themselves a storyline for themselves in the story that included this much suffering, this much heartache, this much betrayal, and this much blood. Unless that's who this God is. See, if Jesus is fully revealing God and what Jesus did was bleed for sin, it's telling you about who this God is. Jesus is the exact representation of his nature, the exact imprint. He radiates his glory. Oh, and by the way, he died for you. What does that tell you about this God? What does that tell you about what he's like? What does it tell you about his heart? If that's what you need to know Jesus has done in order to represent who the Lord is, it should shock you that that's the first thing the author of Hebrews wants you to know about this God. But that's not all this section reveals to us. Not only who Jesus is, not only what Jesus has done, it also answers this really interesting question. What is Jesus doing, like, now? Like, while we're sitting here, what is Jesus doing? Four gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They do a whole host of work from eyewitness accounts on what did Jesus Christ come into the world to do? And they tell you about his life and his ministry, his establishing the kingdom, his betrayal, his suffering, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension. They cover a lot of ground on telling you the life and ministry, the person and work of Jesus. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do. But this fifth gospel, the gospel according to Hebrews, does something at length, and the Hebrews will do a lot of that too. It'll tell us what Jesus has done. But Hebrews does something pretty unique that only a couple spots in the New Testament will do. It tells us explicitly what he's doing now. Not what he did, but what he's doing. And the first part of what he's doing, notice this, verse 3, two things we're going to see that he's doing that go together. But the first part of what he's doing, look at the present active verb in verse 3. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he, here it is, upholds the universe by the word of his power. It's a little flex there, okay? He upholds the universe by the word of his power. That's in the present tense. He upholds it. He's currently doing that. So not only verse 2 would say, we didn't read it, but verse 2 would say he's the agent of creation. God created the world through Jesus. Trinity was present at creation before time existed. Jesus is the agent of creation. Everything was created for him and through him and by him, okay? That's verse 2. Verse 3, oh, and by the way, he's still sustaining the world and the universe that he made. He's presently sustaining it. He's personally and continually involved in sustaining it. That verb there for sustaining can have a little bit of like a misnomer when you read that, hear that word, sustaining or upholding. Because the picture could be like the Greek myth Atlas, who has the globe on his shoulders and on his back. He's like burdened down. He's like holding it up. And there's a version of that that's true, except Jesus wouldn't be bent over. It'd be like flexing it, you know? But the reality is not like, oh, he's burdened by this. He's like, it's just balancing on him. The verb there actually has a connotation too of like, I lift up something and I carry it and I hold it while I'm walking. It's like the carrying that you do when you're carrying a child. You're sustaining, you're upholding, you're keeping that child. Do you know that in order to sustain something, in order to uphold something in this sense, how engaged you have to be with the thing you're holding, with the thing you're keeping? Like, you cannot be a far off, removed entity and truly uphold and sustain something. Like, we can't even sustain our life. And Jesus is sustaining and upholding the universe. And in order for him to do that, sustaining here presumes a proximity. It means he's close to it. It means it's close to him. Upholding presumes a nearness. He's near to the thing that he's carrying. And so what this author has just told you in the first couple of verses, not only that Jesus fully embodies the essence of God. He's the exact imprint of his nature. Not only has he made purification for sin, and that should tell you something about him, but he's currently and presently sustaining the universe. On one level, it sounds like too enormous to comprehend, and it is. But on another level, part of what this punch of the first four verses is trying to do is to try to get you to realize the enormity of the role that Jesus had and has. It's only fit for one person, Jesus, the God-man. Like, no one has ever had a bigger task or a bigger job than Jesus, and that you should feel the weight of that, and then hear this, because this is the second thing that he's currently doing. How is Jesus positioned, it's a critical question, in his holding and keeping the universe, the enormous job that none of us could do? Listen to verse 3 again. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Okay. Do you know what Jesus, do you know how Jesus is positioned currently in his perfect upholding and keeping and sustaining of the universe? He's seated. He's sitting. So like, use your imagination. Use your like theologically informed imagination. What does it mean when a king is seated? It means that he's in a position currently, when a king sits down, he's in a position of power. He's in a position of victory. He's in a position that is showing you he has defeated all of his enemies. Kings don't sit during wartime. They sit when there's peace. They sit when things are settled. To be seated at the right hand of the king was an ancient world like reality that they would have been very familiar with. And the seating of Jesus at God's right hand means that King Jesus has defeated all of God's enemies. And so all the enemies of sin and death and destruction and chaos and darkness and fear and all the things that threaten God and his people and his kingdom, all of them, here's what it means. None of those things threaten him anymore. Like, he's seated. He's not afraid. He's not anxious. Jesus is seated right now. That's the position that he's seated in. Like, while we're here, he's seated. So Jesus incarnates, life, teaching, ministry, kingdom established, betrayal, death, resurrection, and ascension. That's like the life, ministry, person, and work of Jesus. Do you know that after that, after Jesus ascends in the book of Acts, 25 times the New Testament wants to tell you, a lot of them come from the book of Hebrews and in the book of Revelation, a lot of them tell you this line, he's seated at the right hand of God. He's seated at the right hand of God. The king is seated. The king is seated. The king is seated. The king is seated. That's where Jesus is right now. Do you know every other king in history is not seated right now? They're lying down in a grave somewhere, not doing anything. All their power is gone. But not King Jesus. Jesus is not only alive, he's seated on a throne. He's perfectly positioned in his rule, in his authority, in his sustaining, to sustain the universe. How's he sustaining the universe? What's he doing right now? Is he like flipping through the pages on how to find like, well, I guess the first a million plans on this world haven't worked, so we gotta find a new plan? Is he freaking out about what might threaten him and his people and his kingdom and his plan of the universe that he's supposed to sustain? Or is he seated? The promises associated with Jesus being seated at God's right hand means this. He's ruling, he's in control, he's not afraid, and he's at ease. That is what Jesus is currently doing right now, upholding the universe by the word of his power while he's sitting down on a throne. He's calm, he's not worried. And so if you take that reality, not even just like hypothetical, that's real. Jesus is sitting down right now, being at peace and being calm. That means Jesus is sitting over the thing at peace, rested at the thought of the thing that you think is threatening your peace. That means Jesus right now is ruling over the situation in your life that is causing you the most anxiety. He's not anxious about it. That means Jesus is on the throne, above, in charge of, ruling over the nagging thing that you can't stop worrying about. He's not worried about it. I know it's been another week of chaos, from a political assassination in Utah to another school shooting in Colorado. I know that hits real close to home here for many of us. And I know that I don't even have to know all your stories to know that you probably had a week where your future or your finances created some kind of anxiety in you. And I would just say all of those things, my own personal ones too, here's what they're all screaming at you. That no one's behind the wheel driving this world. They're all screaming at you that chaos is gonna win, and they're all screaming at you that the throne is empty. But Hebrews just told you, that's not true. It's not true. I know it feels like chaos is winning, but Hebrews just told you, Jesus is seated on the throne. I can choose, this is not meant to be an exaggeration, I can choose to see any interaction from my day, like my own personal interaction when I talk to myself, my interaction with people, my interaction on the internet, my interaction with my bank account. I can choose to see any interaction from one of two perspectives. I either am gonna see the interaction from an earthly perspective and my view on it, my finite view on it, and what this situation and interaction means for me and about me, or I can see my interactions and my scenarios from a heavenly perspective. And the heavenly perspective is probably what's at stake in every one of your daily interactions. How are you going to choose to see the thing you're in the middle of from your perspective or his? See, because our interactions, they always tempt and taunt us to view the world through what we can read about it and through what we can conclude about it and how this marriage is gonna go and this political reality and this relational dynamic that I'm in and this future anxiety that I have about whatever. It's tempting and taunting me to view it only from my perspective. And what this passage is encouraging you to do is to see it from a different perspective. See it from the seat that Jesus is sitting in right now. It's like when your kids are rebelling, and this is like newborns to like adult children with their own kids. When your children are rebelling and there is strife between you, and you feel like you're losing control, do you realize that those moments and every moment after that is screaming at you to tell you, you've lost control, there's no hope for this, and this is how this is always going to be. There's no king on the throne watching over this. There's no king on the throne ruling over this. There's no king on the throne guiding this, controlling this. And by the way, if there is a king on the throne, he's probably freaking out like you are. Or when you have a romantic desire that gets dashed on the rocks of pain or rejection again. Even if you never like got to a relationship, all you had was a longing for one and it gets dashed and turned. Here's what that scenario is trying to tell you. You'll never be loved in the way that you wish. You'll never be cherished in the way that you wish. You'll never be known. You'll never have intimacy or companionship. There is nobody ruling this world looking out for you. Or when you experience great loss and the sadness and the sorrow become too much to bear and you feel like, I cannot go on another day with this grief, with this hole. I cannot stare down the barrel of the rest of my life because all that screams is abandonment and isolation after what I've lost. It feels like no one's on the throne, and if they are, they don't care if they're even there to begin with. Or maybe you're in a wrestling match with sin and that wrestling match with sin never seems to relent. And so you go one of two places. You either get angry that you're not getting any better at the thing you wish you were getting better at, or secretly what you can't confess to anybody is, I really love my sin. I don't really want to get rid of it. And either of those two paths, here's what they convince you of. You're unfit to be on the throne because look at you. And the one who is on the throne is really disappointed in you. All those possibilities. Those are four. How about a billion others and every mental conversation you have with yourself from every interaction of your day that you would leave and it would command your attention to look at all the storylines and try to figure out how all the money and the timing and the longings, how they could all come together and you look at all of them and here's what it does to you. It creates a lot of inner chaos. We're anxious and we're afraid and here's what we do in our minds. Sometimes with our bodies too, we pace. Because I cannot just sit. We're not seated, as it were. But Jesus is. It's exactly what he's doing. Didn't you hear he's on the throne? He's sitting at the right hand of God the Father, meaning this, he's not anxious about the storylines or the pain or the loss or the worry that you have in your life. He's not anxious about any of those things. He's not threatened by them. He's always at rest. He's seated. Anxious people don't sit. They certainly don't sleep. That you cannot be still when you're anxious. So here's what this passage is telling you. Here's the invitation to draw near. Literally, like by faith and with prayer, here's what you ought to do in your imagination. Go and sit on his lap. He's seated, he's at rest. Go and sit on his lap and listen for these two things in your prayerful imagination. Listen to his heartbeat and listen to his breathing. They are both very slow. He's at peace. And like when you have anxiety, do you know what the New Testament tells you to do? Take your anxiety and cast it onto him because he cares for you. That doesn't mean like a codependent person, he becomes anxious too. Like, oh, well, you're anxious, so I guess I have to be anxious. It doesn't change his state. He's seated still. But the invitation here is to, oh, I can go sit on his lap with prayer and faith, knowing what the Bible tells me is true. And I can actually borrow from his non-anxiousness. I don't have to only see my storylines or my world through my only limited and very finite perspective. And here's what that does when I can do that. It gives me a gift, a rare gift. Nothing else in the world can give you this gift. It gives you the gift of being present. Like fully present, because anxiety always takes you out of the present into the future. You're worried about many cares of tomorrow. Anxiety never leaves you here, unless all that you're doing here is talking about how anxious you are. It always takes you out of this place. Sitting on the lap of Jesus who's seated on the throne, listening to his heartbeat brings you so into the present, you don't lose your emotions. You can weep with him and laugh with him and cry with him and get angry with him. You just can't do it from the perspective of only seeing what you can see. You get to do all those things seeing your world from his perspective. Jesus was, Jesus is, and Jesus will always be on the throne. And because he is at ease there, we can be too. With all the unknowns and all the fears and all the future castings, Jesus is at rest in his heavenly position above all the things that unsettle you. The king is upholding the universe by the word of his power, and hallelujah, that king is sitting on a throne. So there's this quote that I'm gonna close with from one of my old dead friends, Charles Spurgeon. He's a preacher in the 1800s in London. And I've shared this quote with dear friends in different seasons of sadness and anxiety for years, for the last decade, this quote, and they have sent it back to me when they have noticed my own. And this is Spurgeon, Spurgy I call him, old Chuck. He's speaking about the comfort of Jesus sustaining and ruling over your world and of you. So I'm just gonna read it and we're gonna close in prayer and then we'll sing. He says, do you tell me you cannot help looking into the future? Well then, look and peer into the distance as far as your weak vision can reach, but do not breathe upon the telescope with your anxious breath and fancy that you see clouds. Whew. On the contrary, just wipe your eyes with the soft handkerchief of some gracious word of promise and hold your breath while you gaze through that transparent medium. Use the eye salve of faith. Then, whatever you discern of the future, you will also discover this. He rules and overrules. He will make all things work together for good. He will surely bring you through. Goodness and mercy shall follow you all the days of your life, and you shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. He it is who will perform all things for you. Oh, strange infatuation. You see your weakness, you see the temptations that will assail you and the troubles that threaten you, and you are afraid. Look away from them all. This is no business of yours. Leave it in his hands, who will manage well, who will be sure to do the kindest and best thing for you. Be of good confidence and rest in peace. Let's pray. Jesus, seated Jesus, the radiance of the glory of God who has made purification for sin and who is seated on the throne, sustaining the universe. Would you carry us like you carry the cosmos? Would you bring us up onto your lap? Would you hold us close to your chest as we sing and pray and long to be at ease as you are? That all the chaos our eyes can see, all the darkness that our ears take in, would we be present with them in such a way that shows we have a heart, but not lost in the anxiety of them that says that you are not still on your throne. So guide us now as we close in song and give us peace, Jesus, we pray in your name. Amen.